Ryan Devereaux is a journalist for The Intercept, which was co-founded by Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras of Edward Snowden fame, together with Jeremy Scahill. Well, thanks for taking the time to join us, Ryan.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
The Intercept is a groundbreaking publication founded last year, which, quote, produces fearless adversarial journalism across a wide range of issues. I think that is precisely what the world needs today because of governments and media disinformation. So first of all, can you tell us what about The Intercept and its first year and a half of existence? I've read it got off to a rough start. How are things going in your opinion?
I think things are going really well. It's definitely ups and downs. There have been ups and downs, but I think that's kind of natural with any sort of new news organization. I'd be proud of a range of stories that we've done in the sort of short time that we've been around. Managed to break a number of new Snowden stories. We published the watch listing guidance that the U.S. government uses for terrorism watch listing, which civil liberties attorneys have been seeking for years. You know, stories that I think have been in the public interest. I was able to do some reporting from Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed. Some reporting in Mexico on Ayotzinapa and the 43 students that disappeared. My colleagues here have done a lot of great criminal justice coverage, wrongful convictions, death penalty, suspicious death penalty cases here in the U.S. So I think we're doing well. I mean, long way to go still, but I think we're making some serious strides.
And some of the topics you mentioned, you know, some of the stuff is kind of scary. Everything from watch lists, to think that a democratic republic such as the U.S. is now compiling watch lists. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, what feeling do you get investigating all of these stories about things that shouldn't really be happening? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I'm constantly sort of amazed and interested in the ways in which the United States changed after September 11th and the sort of war on terror and the way that that's played out and its intersection with civil rights, civil liberties, privacy to an extent, and the wars that we've been waging for a decade and a half now around the world. It's always interesting to look at these issues and think about what they mean for us when you have something like the sort of watch listing complex that we have in the United States, where the government is working very hard to combat terrorism, but at the same time compiling these massive stockpiles of information and lists and that sort of thing, which, you know, some would argue actually makes their job harder because they build these huge haystacks and then try to find needles in them. I think these are some of the most important issues for journalists to be looking at right now in the United States. And there's a lot of people doing it. And I do think it really matters to inform the public about the sort of place that we find ourselves living now, 2015.
Yeah, they have all that information to go through, and that reminds me of the 1980s film Brazil with Robert De Niro, where I don't know if you've seen it, but they compile lists on the citizens, and they often get things wrong about citizens, and the wrong people get caught up into trouble.
Right. And I mean, here in the United States, it's been largely, Muslim Americans who've borne the brunt of these sorts of systems, and the fear that exists in some communities is really pervasive. And I think that's something that we need to address. We need to not criminalize, substantial portions of our population. It's a real problem.
And before we discuss the drone wars, what is your take and perspective on the global war on terror, which serves as the ideological foundation for the drone wars? Is the war on terror warranted in your opinion? If so, has it utterly failed, or was it a sham from the start?
It's a complicated question. It's a really complicated question. Uh-huh. I mean, terrorism is a real thing. And there are real threats to the United States that exist. That said, the reaction to the attacks on September 11th has been a calamity in a lot of ways. Two countries invaded. In a sort of cycle of violence that doesn't seem to be ending. It's you know, one sort of challenge and disaster after another, after another, after another. And it's extremely difficult to see any end in sight, and a real erosion of, you know, civil liberties along the way. These are extremely complicated issues. To say that the whole thing has failed, I don't know. Certainly the Iraq War was a monumental historic disaster for which this country should, be ashamed. You know, policymakers in this country, the people who made that possible. At the same time, I mean, it is the case that, you know, there are violent organizations that exist in the world that would like to do harm, but the ways in which we responded to them at times have been really, I believe, short-sighted, to say the least.
In terms of global warfare, well, the world seems to be entering uncharted territory. Science fiction writers like H.G. Wells wrote about unmanned flying machines a century ago. How do the drone wars change the global battlefield? I believe The Intercept just a few days ago, or was it a week or two ago, released the drone papers. And so how does this change everything, the global battlefield? And tell us about these drone wars.
Well, I mean, I think that, yeah, there's a lot of sort of focus and sort of obsessing over the technology itself, right? The drones they're unmanned and they fly, and, you know, they have this dispersed network of people supporting these operations, personnel in a base in the United States and personnel, you know, a base in Afghanistan and a drone that's flying over Pakistan. You know, it's so that's all very interesting. And for this sort of technology geeks out there, there's a lot of fascinating stuff to dig into about those sort of technological advances. But I think what's kind of most interesting to me about the whole issue of drones, it's not the drones itself, it's the way in which this war, the war on terror, looks now. And there's this idea that has sort of persisted post 9/11 that, you know, you can just kill high value targets, right? Decapitate the heads of these organizations, and that this in and of itself approaches something like a coherent strategy in combating terror. But that just doesn't seem to be the case. You know, you kill one second in command guy and somebody steps into fill his shoes, and so on and so forth, and it repeats itself. It's not a complete sort of strategy to deal with, you know, what I think really is the extension of, you know, bigger structural issues in the regions in which these operations are taking place. I mean, I think the drones are sort of the tip of the iceberg in what should be a much broader conversation about the way in which the United States is asserting itself in the war on terror. There are real serious questions about the legality of some of the operations in certain countries, certainly in the countries where the United States is not officially at war, where international law mandates that certain precautions be taken in the event that the United States is seeking to use legal force. You know, when you're launching a lethal airstrike in a country where you're not at war, the standards are very high for a military to do that sort of thing under international law. But the United States has been, U.S. government, the Obama administration, has been really, withheld a lot of information about how it regulates its program, how it determines whether it's efficient and complies with international law. And it's been a source of major frustration for human rights investigators, human rights lawyers, you know, journalists who cover this beat. We get a lot of assertions about the precision, legality, and efficacy of these operations from U.S. Administration officials, and we have no independent sort of documentary evidence to really to really assess those claims. What we have are researchers on the ground who point to significant numbers of civilian casualties. We have evidence that indicates a sort of blowback from these type of operations. But in terms of, you know, anything from the government that actually tells us in their own sort of documents how this is all going, it's been a tremendous challenge to get that sort of information. So the drone papers, the series that we did that you referenced, it's a number of documents detailing elements of the U.S. military's drone program that gives us some sense, at least a little bit more information now to make those assessments, for the public to be able to make those assessments.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and I was going to ask that about regarding international law, because as I mentioned, I think we are in uncharted territory, and so what needs to be constructed and taken into account internationally is, you know, how are we going to deal with these issues with drones, and as you mentioned, in different countries, the legality. You wrote about in your article about the CIA's role and how they seem to be overstepping their bounds. And from what I got with the article, it seemed Brennan, the CIA director, he seemed kind of insincere in saying he'd look into these matters. And some of the other points you brought up were the accuracy of the intelligence that the drone operators receive on their targets never seems to be 100%. Which can often, I mean, we've seen, like, I think you cited almost 1,000 known official civilian deaths between 400 to 950. You know, what about the human costs?
I mean, the human costs, from what we can tell, are tremendous. You know, places where people live in intense fear because they find themselves caught between U.S. counterterrorism operations, drone strikes, and that sort of thing, and insurgent groups or militant groups like the Taliban. You have regular people who live in some of these areas and find themselves really between a rock and a hard place, you know, between these different families. This is not to excuse the Taliban or, you know, different militant groups that do exist in the world. I think if those groups do present security challenges for the civilians living in those areas, but so do the U.S. operations to try to target those folks. I mean, so you have people really caught in the middle, and we have evidence from human rights groups and researchers and journalists who spent time in these places that do indicate, you know, significant civilian casualties. And the United States government has been really just done a terrible job at adequately addressing those cases. I mean, we had an incident earlier this year where two Western hostages were killed in a mistaken drone strike in Pakistan, a CIA drone strike. And in a sort of remarkable turn of events, President Obama apologized for that strike. So, I mean, he took responsibility for this operation, right? He acknowledged that, that this was a mistake, and the United States bears responsibility for its counterterrorism missions. But, I mean, for a lot of people who have reported on these issues, investigated these sorts of stories, it's kind of stunning, because there have been so many cases over the last decade and a half where victims have come forward describing what happened to their family members, describing, you know, dead loved ones, and they never receive, an apology from the president. I mean, it's nice to see the administration taking ownership in a case, but there have been a lot of cases, and there's been no real substantive answers to very, very important questions about how this stuff is actually playing out on the ground.
I'm not sure if you have covered it, but what are your thoughts of the use of drones domestically? They've said that in the near future, you know, we might have tens of thousands of drones domestically in the States. Have you done any investigation on that? What are your thoughts of just in general the increased use of drones domestically?
I haven't done any reporting on drone use domestic drone use in the United States. I have done reporting on sort of counterterrorism investigations in the United States, and those have pointed to, you know, sort of some issues of civil liberties sort of being violated, Muslim communities being spied upon, and that sort of thing. I mean, I think that the rise in domestic drone use, depending on, you know, the sort of context that you're talking about, does raise important questions, but it's not something that I've spent time looking at as a reporter.
Just the last question on the drone issue. What do you think should concern U.S. citizens regarding the U.S. government's use of drones abroad, as we've been talking about? I mean, what do you think U.S. citizens should be, you know, contemplating in all of this news and reporting that we're reading and listening to about what's happening abroad with the drone issue?
Well, I mean, a couple of things, I guess. When officials tell us that these are really surgical and precise systems, I think it's important for the public to remember that the government has offered very little to prove those claims, and there's been substantial evidence, at least in you know, in the case of Afghanistan over particular periods, and in certain strikes, you know, around the world in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, that indicates that that is not in fact the case, right? That there are serious problems in the way that these systems are, you know, in the way that they operate. I mean, it's the technology is advanced, and they can hit a moving vehicle in a remote location, you know, with an unmanned vehicle, and that's totally true. But it's not whether or not they can hit what they're pointing at. It's the intelligence process that goes into pointing it at that vehicle in the first place. The second thing I think that people would do well to remember is that the drones are just part of a bigger sort of conversation, I think, that is important for the public to have about where we are in terms of our foreign policy and the wars that we have been bound up in for the last decade and a half. I mean, it's become a sort of way of life since September 11th that the United States is constantly engaged in multiple countries around the world in an attempt to fight terrorism. And we need to ask, really, I mean, when does this end? Does it end? Have we created something that is too big to stop? I mean, 15 years is a really long time, and that's what we're approaching. I mean, those are profound questions that I think we need to be asking ourselves, and drones are just a part of that.
Mm-hmm. And let's move on to the final topic regarding Mexico, which I believe you've visited and covered lately, the disappearances of the 43 students, the murders. And I believe you interviewed one of the parents of the victims. And the conclusions of both the parents and the Human Rights Committee, the findings come to the conclusion that the murders or disappearances must have been coordinated across the state security apparatus. What can you tell us about that? What is the big takeaway from the story for us, for Mexicans, for Americans, and world citizens alike, as well as your experience going down to Mexico?
Yeah, so I went. I first came down to Mexico to cover the Ayotzinapa story in November last year. I came down for about a month, and I spent a good amount of time with students at the school, the surviving students and parents of the disappeared students. And then I subsequently after that, I obtained a number of files from the PGR's investigation. So the testimonies and statements of alleged Guerreros Unidos members and municipal police from Iguala and Cocula. That investigation has now been, those same files have now been made public by PGR finally. But the conclusions that I came to in the process of my reporting are essentially the same conclusions that the Inter-American Commission investigators came to, which they published in their massive report a few weeks back, which is that there is ample evidence, documentary evidence, which shows that at the very minimum, basically every level of the security apparatus in and around Iguala that night was at least aware of what was going on. Kokula and Iguala Municipal Police were directly involved in attacking the students and disappearing them. But the army knew what was happening in real time as was happening. There were army patrols from the 27th Infantry Battalion and others, including plainclothes military intelligence on the ground while all of this was happening. The ministerial police, the state police, the federal police all played interlocking roles throughout the night. And this is what journalists, a lot of us have been saying, for months. And the Inter-American Commission came to the same conclusions. And obviously the federal government, PGR, has, fought sort of assertions from the beginning. I think that there's just so much more work that needs to be done in determining what really happened that night and why it happened. I think that the theory that was floated by the Inter-American team that the students may have inadvertently boarded a bus with drugs bound for the United States is certainly a provocative and interesting theory. I think that what you have in that case is a case in which these students found themselves in a really terrible situation, in that the in and around Iguala, the line between organized crime and the security forces there had disappeared a long time ago. When I was down there, we went to a church in Iguala that's become a sort of organizational hub in the area where family members of people who had disappeared in before the students disappeared came, and they were given the opportunity to tell their stories and register for a database. That was the idea was to collect DNA from these family members to, in an attempt to sort of identify some of the people who were being pulled out of all of these mass graves around Iguala. And it was like 80 or 90 people who showed up in the church just that one day, who were all coming forward with their own experiences of family members who'd been disappeared. So my point is that that area, it was just sort of awash in fear and impunity. And I think that's what this case really underscored. And the local security forces, the police and the military all play a role in it. They're all implicated. It's a story that says so much about the sort of epidemic of enforced disappearances across Mexico and the drug war. And really the United States bears, just tremendous responsibility for in that, the United States prohibition policies help to fuel a black market, which undermines the authority of the state. And, U.S. weapons flow into Mexico basically unabated, and the United States, sends billions of dollars in military, law enforcement, intelligence aid, equipment, training, support to Mexican security forces that year after year are implicated in gross human rights abuses. So, it's all, we're all sort of bound up in this mess together. And I think that this case, the Ayotzinapa case, just really just drove that point home. It's tremendously sad. It's the saddest story that I've ever covered before. Just talking to the parents and thinking about what it would be like to go through what they've gone through over the last years. It's awful.
And state terror is nothing new. If you look at it in history and around the world in different countries today, we see state terrorism. And what I find interesting here in Mexico is when it happens in Mexico, all Mexicans know, they know that the government was involved one way or another. And, sometimes I get foreign students from Europe and the U.S. and they have a really hard time with some of these things. They're a bit too naive, I guess. But I had an interesting story regarding when the disappearances happened. We have a lot of foreign students, exchange students, and some were down there near Ayotzinapa traveling, and they were leaving in a van, like a tourist vehicle, a small van.
Yeah.
And the police were attempting to stop them. And they wouldn't stop because, as you mentioned, it's such a gray area. You know who's stopping you if they really are police, yeah, or if they are narcos, or if they are police working police with the narcos. So you don't want to stop for the police. And so they didn't.
No.
They didn't stop, and they ended up shooting. The cops ended up shooting at the vehicle, and they shot one of our foreign students from our school.
That was one of your students. I know the story you're talking about.
Yeah, they shot him in the butt. Apparently, I'm not sure, but I think it's yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was.
I mean, I remember when that story came out. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. So go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to talk about the other story you mentioned as well, being a Mexican journalist. And I've spoken with a British journalist based here in Guadalajara who writes for Vice, and he's written about it as well, that on average one Mexican journalist is murdered per month now by the narco state.
I mean, it's incredible, like, people would ask me when I came back, like, oh, you know, aren't you, isn't that scary to do that sort of reporting in Mexico before for a white journalist in the United States? I mean, there's just no comparison in, like, it's hard for me to even like answer that sort of question, because what journalists in Mexico face, like Mexican journalists, especially local reporters in some of these communities, is just tremendous fear. And I mean, it's just an incredible level of danger. And there are journalists in Mexico who are doing amazing work, mm-hmm, despite those sorts of threats. I mean, there are some very, very good, serious investigative reporters in Mexico, and I have, you know, the utmost respect for them and what they're able to do despite the conditions as they are. I mean, it's a really overwhelming set of topics. Mm-hmm. Security, Mexico, the narco state, the drug war. It's just overwhelming.
And what might you say? You know, we know this is happening in Mexico, and we've heard of the stories of the U.S. journalists, you know, back, 20 years ago, Gary Webb, who was portrayed by Jeremy Renner in Kill the Messenger last year, the Hollywood movie, as well as Michael Hastings, who wrote for The Rolling Stone. You know, they died under suspicious circumstances. I'm of the opinion that, you know, the U.S. government was involved somehow. I don't know. What are your thoughts regarding, you know, these few examples of American journalists that have either died under suspicious circumstances or things that have happened to them?
Well, so I've written about Gary Webb's story before. And sort of what happened with him, and Gary Webb's family maintains that he did kill himself, mm-hmm, that he did in fact take his own life. I mean, the story of the way in which his life unraveled there at the end, Kill the Messenger, the book, is really worth reading to dig into that. It's totally tragic. I mean, a phenomenal, great reporter who, you know, was by and large really on the right track in his reporting, and actually was just re-reporting revelations that the AP had made years before, the Associated Press. Michael Hastings was a friend of mine. He was a friend and a mentor, and his death really hit a lot of us here in New York who knew him pretty hard. I don't think that the U.S. government killed Michael. It was a tragic accident. But the thing that both Michael and Gary Webb had in common, I guess, is just that the work that they did is incredibly stressful, incredibly high stakes work, and it really can wear on an individual. And they were both accredited to the profession, and it's just, it does, the, you know, the U.S. government doesn't need to assassinate journalists, nor should it, obviously, but the profession on its own can really wear a person down, and it's very difficult work. Yeah.
Okay. And my final question, your final thoughts, as well as what words of wisdom would you have for the youth or the next generation, as well as, you know, conscientious citizens, you know, citizens who should be doing their duty, always examining and questioning the government and making sure they're on the right track, and citizens that will continue to deal with these issues that The Intercept is writing about. So what are your final thoughts, as well as words of wisdom to the young people who seem a bit distracted today, and I wish that they would be focusing on some of these important issues?
I don't know if I have that much wisdom to impart, but I just read a lot, and I mean, there's a lot of fascinating stories out there, and it's easy to get overwhelmed with all of it, and it all seems pretty grim, and everything is horrifying and whatnot. But you know, I think it's important and really interesting once you start digging into, you know, the world that we live in right now. I mean, it's a complicated place, and there are so many stories to follow. And you know, I think it's worthwhile to do.
Okay, well, thank you, Ryan Devereaux, for your time. I highly recommend people check out your reports at theintercept.com. Are there any websites that you recommend in addition?
No, I mean, there's a whole host of them. We can start there.